Chapter 3 The Looters 1 Larry lived in a brick house a mile inland and 3 miles south of Mercer's cottage. He spent the morning with his chainsaw clearing limbs and debris from his front yard, then left in his pickup to explore. But it was hopeless. Trees were down everywhere, and all streets were blocked. He returned home, loaded a backpack with food and water, and set out on foot to check on his properties. He looked after 5 of them, all vacation homes on the beach owned by old clients. The devastation was unlike any he had seen in his 50-plus years on the island. Trees were strewn across roofs, lawns, cars, and trucks. Trees that would take days to cut up and remove stretched across streets and roads. Entire subdivisions were isolated. It took 2 hours to get to Fernando Street, the main drag along the beach. There he found less damage, primarily because there were fewer trees. The dunes had served their purpose and held back the storm surge, but the homes and cottages had been battered by the wind. He saw few people moving about. A good sign that most folks had fled. Helicopters and small planes buzzed about like menacing insects, so help was on the way. He passed a crew of guardsmen clearing the road and stopped to chat with a sergeant. According to him, the northern end took the brunt of the storm. The Hilton was gutted. The body count was at 8 and rising. The injured were being taken to Jacksonville. The bridge was now open to first responders, but the residents would be kept away for days. At Mercer's cottage, Larry found the front lawn covered with leaves, small branches, broken boards, and roofing shingles. He went inside and found no water damage, no leaks. The roof had held the place together nicely. On the deck facing the ocean, he surveyed the cottage and was proud that his plywood sheets had protected all doors and windows. He would leave it boarded up for a few days. The boardwalk over the dunes was intact until the end, where the final platform and steps had been washed away by the surge. He looked up and down the beach and saw that both piers were gone. He sat on the boardwalk, hung his feet over the dunes, sipped a bottle of water, and watched the action. A mile away at a public beach, a staging operation was getting organized. A Navy Seahawk chopper circled as another attempted to land on the beach. An amphibious landing craft approached from the sea. There were advantages to living close to the naval base in Jacksonville. When he finished the bottle, he returned to the cottage, studying the roof as he walked. A few shingles were missing, but nothing major. 3 houses down, the deck had been blown away and all windows were shattered. He locked the cottage and returned to Fernando Street to head home. With no phone service, there was nothing to report. He lived alone and had enough food and water for 2 weeks. He was relieved that he had been lucky. His home was not damaged. However, with no electricity, conditions would not improve. He suspected that in a day or so, he would be wishing he was in a nice, cool motel 200 miles away. Next time, he would probably evacuate with the sensible folks. 2. The cleanup effort at Bob's lasted less than an hour. After ripping out the first floor carpets and hauling out the ruined rugs, the 3 were soaked with sweat and exhausted. During a break, Bob said, "You know, I really should wait until the insurance adjuster takes a look, don't you think?" Bruce quickly replied, "Great idea. He'll hire a crew to clean up, right?" "It's in the policy," Bob said. "I pay $6,000 a year for supplemental flood insurance, so I'm covered." Nick said, "Here's a better idea. Let's load up the food, water, and booze and get out of here. Take it all back to Bruce's and set up camp." Bob said, "But my car took 5 feet of water. It won't start. I've already tried." Nick said, "Okay, but Nelson's BMW is high and dry. He won't be using it. I've got the keys in my pocket."
"You took his keys?"
"Sure, they were on the kitchen counter. House keys, too."
"What if the cops come back to investigate?" Bruce asked. I doubt if they'll be back this week, and they can get in if they want.
You want to steal his car?
Bob asked. No, I want to borrow it. Downtown is at least 3 miles away and through a minefield. It's a disaster, Bob. Every dog for himself. Different rules apply. I say we raid Nelson's fridge and pantry and take the good stuff. It's just going to rot anyway.
Bruce said, I like it. We take the food, borrow the car, bring it back when the roads are clear. The cops are far too busy elsewhere.
What if they stop us?
For doing what? They won't know we're driving a dead man's car.
All right, all right.
In his upstairs guest room, Bob emptied 2 large plastic containers filled with old clothes. They loaded them with 4 thawing steaks and a chicken from his freezer, some cold cuts and cheese, 8 bottles of beer, 3 bottles of bourbon, and 2 bottles of vodka. Bob locked his condo, and they set off, lugging their loot. Bob said,
If the cops see us, they'll start shooting.
Do you see any cops?
I don't see anyone.
Minutes later, they arrived back at Nelson's, all 3 panting and even more exhausted. They entered through the rear patio so they would not be seen, though there was no one to see them. Bruce went to the garage and tried to open the overhead door. It wouldn't budge until he found the manual bypass switch next to the motor. He and Nick grunted and pulled until the door was open. They quickly filled the trunk with canned goods and boxes of pasta from the pantry, bacon, eggs, and cheese from the fridge. The freezer was empty except for 2 steaks and 2 frozen pizzas, gluten-free. They took them, then made a generous haul from Nelson's bar. He liked good scotch, and they helped themselves to it, along with every other bottle they could grab. Luckily, they found an entire case of imported sparkling water. Since Bruce knew more cops than Bob or Nick, he was chosen as the driver. Nick lifted the yellow crime scene tape, and Bruce eased the car under it. They were in the street, their borrowed car packed with loot and headed toward downtown, certain they would be stopped and arrested. The 15-minute drive took 2 hours as they weaved around fallen trees, got blocked at almost every turn, negotiated through police barriers, and waited at unnecessary checkpoints. They passed a few residents cleaning up, all dazed and tired. They passed a few other cars. The police and guardsmen were busy, stressed, suspicious, and of little help. They were in rescue mode and had no time for curious sightseers. One helpful policeman saved them with directions that led to a gravel road along a marsh. They parked in Bruce's driveway and immediately ran to the kitchen for a bottle of water. The generator was rattling away on the terrace, and Bruce turned it off. He had less than 5 gallons of gasoline. All breakers were off except for the refrigerator, freezer, and a circuit that cooled and lit the kitchen and den. The rest of the house was hot and muggy. They unloaded the car, stashed away the food and drinks, opened 3 bottles of cold beer, and sat in the den for a long rest. Bob, who had slept not a wink before, during, and after the storm, soon nodded off in his chair. Nick followed him on the sofa. Bruce needed a nap too, but his mind was racing. He restarted the generator and set the thermostat on 80. Tomorrow's priority would be gasoline. He left his men to their slumbers and began walking. His bookstore was only 4 blocks away, and as tired as he was, he needed the exercise. The floodwaters had receded to a point about a block from the harbor. 2 police cars were parked in the center of Main Street. Barricades kept away traffic that did not exist. Bruce knew one of the officers and shook hands with both of them. They passed along the latest rumors. The phone company was hard at work on a temporary cell tower. Might have service as early as tomorrow. 10 dead now, with about a dozen missing, but there was no way to know if they were really missing or in a motel somewhere. A tornado did some damage 10 miles to the west, but no one was hurt.
The bridge was open to rescue personnel, volunteers, and supplies, but not to residents. Not sure when the islanders would be allowed to return. Electricity was a priority, but would take days. Crews were arriving from as far away as Orlando. Generators were pouring in. All stores were ordered closed until further notice, except for Kroger, which had a large generator and was open for business. More guard units were on the way. Bruce walked to his store and unlocked the front door with great trepidation. One day before, he and his crew had managed to move 10,000 books to the second floor, where they were now safe and dry, as were the rugs and most of the shelving. On the first floor, the heart pine floors were wet and muddy and probably ruined. Judging from the stains on the wall behind the cash register, the floodwaters reached a height of exactly 4.5 feet before they receded. Oh well, he had plenty of insurance and plenty of money. Everything could be repaired, and before long, he would be back in business. It could have been far worse. He climbed the stairs and walked onto the balcony where he had shared many cappuccinos and lots of good wine with friends and touring riders. He had met Nelson there, not that many years ago. The madness of the past 24 hours had muddled his brain and made clear thinking impossible. During the storm, his frightened thoughts had been on physical survival. Once it passed, he went into a panic phase as he desperately worried about damage to his home and store. And now, after seeing Nelson, he was on the verge of bewilderment. The murder theory was giving him headaches. He breathed deeply and tried to imagine the phone call to Nelson's parents. Surely the police had made contact by now, and surely his family was frantically trying to reach someone on the island who knew more. He felt an obligation to at least attempt to contact them. Not for the first time, he contemplated loading up Bob and Nick and making a run for it. In his car, not Nelson's. They could drive 2 hours, probably south, and find cell service and a motel. Bruce could call the Kerr family and also check in with Mercer, Myra, and Lee, and other friends. But once off the island, it might be impossible to return. And where was Nelson's dog? And how many pets were lost in the storm? The breathing helped little, and his nerves were still frayed. He walked up a narrow stairway to his old apartment on the third floor and found a bottle of single malt. The air was thick and musty, so he returned to the balcony and poured a strong one. After a few sips, he felt himself relax, and soon he was able to hold on to one thought at a time. He assumed the state crime lab would conduct a proper autopsy. The storm had caused other fatalities, and the lab might get stressed somewhat, but for a murder, it would certainly take its time. If the autopsy confirmed Nick's theory, then what was the next step? Trusting Hoppy Durden to get to the bottom of things seemed like a joke. He seemed to have little interest in a possible homicide. Who would inform Nelson's parents that he was not only dead, but had been murdered? It was entirely plausible that Hoppy and his bosses would show little sympathy for some clown venturing outdoors in a Cat 4 and getting hit by falling limbs. Faced with what appeared to be an unsolvable crime, they could easily decide to embrace the theory that there was no crime at all, just an accident. Nelson was new to the island, kept to himself, and had few friends, and he was a writer anyway, and those folks are known to be odd. Blame it on flying debris and close the file. Bruce finished his drink, returned the bottle to the apartment, and left Bay Books. He walked to Noel's shop to assess the damage. 3. There was enough charcoal to fill the grill, and Bruce built a raging fire. He cooked Nelson's steaks first, for their dinner, then grilled sausages, hot dogs, pork chops, and everything else in the freezer, which was running at 1/4 speed. When the coals were perfect, he put on 2 whole chickens. They ate on the veranda in fading sunlight and washed down the steaks with a bottle of Syrah. When they finished, Bruce cleared the table and poured more wine. Bob suddenly stood, cracked his knuckles, and said, "Okay, boys, I have to get this off my chest. I'm not sure I'll tell the cops. I don't know what to do, so I want your advice." He was suddenly fidgety and nervous and began pacing back and forth. "I had a woman with me last night. Said her name was Ingrid. Met her on Friday at the bar in the Hilton. A real looker. Probably 40 years old with a body like you've never seen. Said she had a black belt and lived in the gym. Said she was staying at the hotel for a few days of beach time. I took her home, she spent the night, and man, she was something. A real handful, all muscle and tone. She hung around. We had lunch with Nelson on Saturday, and he couldn't take his eyes off her. She stayed over that night, too. Couldn't get enough. She almost killed me. I'm 54, you know, and my stamina ain't bad. A lot of practice, but I couldn't keep up. I thought about bringing her to dinner Sunday at your place to meet Mercer, and of course to show off, but thought better of it. When the storm turned our way, she was planning to leave at first. Then she decided to stay, which was okay with me. If I could ride out the storm, then so could she. When it hit, though, she panicked. I mean, really freaked out and wanted to go back to the hotel. I was worried about the flood surge because my street is lower than the others, and when I said I thought we might get some water, she went nuts on me. We had a fight, nothing physical. I figured she could snap my neck if she wanted to, but there was a lot of yelling and cussing. She bolted just after dark. I mean, she ran out of my condo into the storm with me yelling at her the whole time. She went crazy, slap-ass crazy, and I let her go. I mean, hell. She was just a hookup, you know? Nothing serious. I figured if she wanted to disappear into wind strong enough to roll over a car, then so be it. My last image was her disappearing down the street, leaning sideways into the wind, struggling to keep her feet. Bob sat down and gulped his wine. They waited, and finally Bruce asked, "Is that the end of it?" "No. A few minutes later, Nelson called. The last call before we lost service. He told me she was at his place and acting really bizarre. What was going on? I said I didn't know. He said he would try to take care of her." Another pause, and Bruce asked, "Okay. Anything else?" "No, that's all." For a long time, nothing was said. Bob had settled down, but was breathing heavily, his eyes drooping, defeated. "I don't know how to handle this," he mumbled. Bruce said, "Well, you have to tell the police, that's for certain." "I suppose. But I really don't want to get involved. After meeting Officer Hoppy, I don't have much faith in these cops. Hell, he'll probably suspect me, and I don't need that." "How can he suspect you? I have a record." "Come on, that's history. You can't be a suspect. Stranger things have happened." "Did you get her last name?" Nick asked. "Murphy. Ingrid Murphy, from Atlanta. But I doubt if any of that is true." "The hotel will have records," Bruce said. "Maybe. Right now the hotel is about to tilt over. You saw it today. They'll probably condemn it." Nick said, "I doubt if she was staying there." Both looked at him confused. "What are you talking about?" Bruce asked. "If she's the last person known to be with Nelson before he was bludgeoned to death, then let's assume she is the killer. Indulge me here, okay? I honestly doubt the same tree hit him 4 times. Someone took a blunt weapon and cracked his skull, right? Given her physical attributes that Bob has so nicely described, she has the capability." "So what's the motive?" Bruce asked. "There is none." "How did she meet Nelson?" Nick asked Bob. Bob replied, "Like I said, we had lunch. Was it her idea? Bob scratched his chin, thought for a moment, and said,
Well, sort of. She claimed to be a big reader, liked my books and all, and we talked about other writers on the island. When I said Nelson was a friend, she got excited, clicked off all his titles, seemed to know them inside and out.
Odd, Nick said. Not exactly girl stuff.
I thought the same thing.
Nick said, Ingrid just met Nelson, and then she killed him. But it wasn't random. She came here for that purpose. The motive was money, because she was paid to do the job.
Where did you have lunch?
At the shack, down under the bridge.
Where I'll bet they don't have cameras, Nick said.
Herman probably doesn't lock the door at night, Bruce said.
Who suggested the shack? Nick asked.
So you're still the detective, huh?
I bet it was her idea.
Bob scratched his chin more, tried to remember.
Matter of fact, it was her idea. She said she had read about the place and wanted to try it. This sounded true because it gets its share of reviews, travel magazines and stuff. Keep going, Sherlock. I want to hear your theory.
She set you up. She managed to catch your eye around the hotel bar where you're known to prowl. She got you in the sack, surprise, surprise, and you led her to Nelson, the target. She got lucky when the storm took aim at us and provided the perfect setting. A murder in the middle of a hurricane. She's a pro, fearless, tough, and waited until the storm had passed and daylight was coming and made her getaway. She'll probably never be found. I bet you $100, which I don't have, that she was not registered at the Hilton.
Bruce appeared dumbfounded.
Anything else?
Just speculating, of course. But I'll bet she had a team with her. Probably rented a condo for a week or two, had plenty of backup, and they knew how to get off the island about the time that Leo was leaving. Don't ask me how.
So what was the murder weapon? Bob asked.
We may never know, but it could have been Nelson's 7-iron. I looked at his clubs this morning when you two were sitting on the patio. There's a stain and some matter on the 7-iron. Could be blood, I don't know. I didn't touch anything. When swung properly, a 7-iron, or any iron for that matter, can do some real damage to a skull.
Bruce asked Bob.
And she was strong enough to move his body?
Oh, sure. I weighed 200 pounds, and she really bounced me around. Of course, I wasn't resisting, mind you.
Nelson weighed 170 at most.
Bruce said, But there was no electricity. How could she find his golf clubs with no lights?
He had at least 2 flashlights. We used one this morning. Maybe she had been there before. Maybe someone else scoped the place when Nelson wasn't home.
A lot of maybes, Bob said.
You got quite an imagination.
I do. Let's hear your theory.
I don't have one, and I'm not thinking too clearly right now. Hell, we don't even know if it's a murder. I say we wait till the autopsy.
They sat in the darkness and listened to the distant sounds of their battered island. A gas engine generator was rattling a street or two over. A helicopter was making a night run in the direction of the beach. A siren wailed far away. But none of the usual languid nighttime sounds. Neighbors laughing on their porches. Music emanating from stereos. Dogs barking. Cars easing down the street, the distant horn of a shrimp boat entering the harbor.
Bruce slapped a mosquito on his neck and said, That's it. Let's go inside.
He started his generator, closed the terrace door, and they regrouped in the den where the air was a bit cooler. All lights were off, but for a small table lamp by the television. Bruce set it on a card table and said, How about some poker? He poured a round of single malt from Nelson's collection, and they toasted their late friend. The alcohol mixed with the fatigue, and the poker was cut short. Bob slept on one sofa, Nick on another. Bruce stretched out in his recliner and soon fell asleep to the rickety hum of his generator.
4. Breakfast was coffee and a cheese sandwich. The gasoline supply was becoming critical, and they discussed it as they ate.
Nelson's car had half a tank, and Bob suggested they drain most of it with a section of garden hose. Bruce and Nick confessed to having no siphoning experience, so Bob took charge and managed to withdraw about 10 gallons without poisoning himself. With that project complete, they decided that the next priority was returning Nelson's car. Bruce checked the doors and locked the house, set the alarm with his remote, and left in his Chevy Tahoe. Bob and Nick followed in Nelson's BMW, and it took an hour to wind their way around the devastation. Not surprisingly, there was no one at the condo, no homicide team sifting for clues, no neighbors picking up debris. No one had touched the yellow crime scene tape. Bruce lifted it, and Bob returned the BMW to its spot. The three met in the garage and stared at the golf clubs, but said nothing. They closed the overhead door, walked into the kitchen, and discussed Nelson's keys. If they left them behind, there was the chance that someone might break in, find them, and steal the car. But they agreed that this was a long shot. If they took them, the police wouldn't know the difference and would have no trouble entering. Nick kept them in his pocket. As they settled into the Tahoe, Bruce said, "I have an idea. We could sit around here today and tomorrow and get nothing done. I'm kind of bored with this hurricane crap. Let's pack a bag, head to the bridge, and see what the situation is there. If we can escape, we can drive to Jacksonville, visit the crime lab, snoop around, and maybe learn something. Then we can drive a few hours and find a nice hotel with hot water and phones that work. Who's in?" "Me," Bob said. "Let's go," Nick said. They drove to Bob's cul-de-sac and waited for him to gather some clean underwear and a shaving kit. They weaved through heavy debris and made it to Fernando Street, where the two lanes were now passable. The shoulders, curbs, and bike lanes were piled high with debris, and small bulldozers were pushing more of it around. Dozens of utility crews worked frantically. It took another hour to get to the home of Nick's grandparents, and to his relief, it was not heavily damaged. It was half a mile from the beach, and the falling limbs had missed the roof. Nick found a trash bag and filled it with perishables from the freezer and refrigerator. The meats and cheeses were already spoiling. Thankfully, his grandparents had been away for 2 months, and there wasn't much food in the house. He couldn't cook and lived on cold cuts and carry out pizza. He threw some clean clothes in a backpack, locked the front door, took a photo to send to his grandparents, tossed the trash bag onto the neighbor's porch, and jumped into the rear seat. "Where are your grandparents?" Bob asked as they drove away. "Idaho, last I heard. I really need to call them. I'm sure they're worried sick." "As are a lot of folks," Bruce said. Half an hour later, they parked in his driveway and hustled about. Bob turned off the generator as Nick again stuffed perishables into two large coolers. Bruce ran upstairs to pack some clothes. He was already thinking about a hot shower. They fixed a box full of sandwiches and loaded up as much food, water, beer, and wine as they could stuff into the Tahoe. They were not sure where they were headed, but wanted to be prepared. At the bridge, 1,000 emergency lights were flashing and uniformed officers milled around with National Guardsmen. Traffic was being waved on, and there was a line of cars and trucks leaving the island. In the other lanes, supply trucks, utility crews, and emergency vehicles were arriving. Bruce parked the Tahoe and walked to the crowd at the bridge. He saw a policeman he knew and pulled him aside. He said, "We're thinking about leaving for a day or so, but don't want to get stranded. How can we get back on the island?" The officer lit a cigarette and said, "Word is the bridge will open both ways at noon tomorrow, but they are discouraging folks from returning. It could be a week with no electricity." "Great. What's the body count?" "Still at 11, as of midday." Bruce frowned and shook his head. "We're headed to Jacksonville. Do they have electricity?" "It was blacked out yesterday. Supposedly getting some power back today."
"Are things better north or south?"
"South. Leo turned to the north and is now drenching Atlanta. I'd go south, probably as far as Orlando, if you're looking for a room."
They crossed the bridge without incident,
but were soon bumper to bumper on the mainland. Thousands of pine trees had been scattered like straw, and crews were working to clear the roads. The traffic lights had been blown away, and state police directed traffic. They inched along, listening to the news on the radio and munching on snacks. The 30-minute drive to Interstate 95 took 2 hours, and the interchange was gridlocked. According to the news, most of southern Georgia was without power as Leo stalled again near Atlanta. Record flooding was being reported from Savannah to Columbus. They were clipping along at 40 miles per hour on the Jacksonville bypass when their phones came to life. Service at last. Bruce called Noelle in Switzerland and brought her up to date. Nick called his parents in Knoxville and left a voicemail with his grandparents wherever they were. Bob called a daughter in Texas and reported that he was fine, uninjured, and happily off the island. Bruce called Mercer, who was tucked in her apartment in Oxford and watching cable nonstop. He did not mention Nelson because he did not want a longer conversation. He would have more time later. He called Myra and Lee, who were still in Pensacola. He called 3 of his employees to see where they were staying and asked when they might return. Nick called the crime lab to see if it was open. Bob had suggested that it had to be because the morgue had to be chilled, right? Nick was told that the lab was operating on a limited basis and expecting full electricity in a matter of hours. He pressed the receptionist for information about their buddy, Nelson Kerr, but got nowhere. Bob's app said the traffic south was much heavier than that to the west, so they turned onto Interstate 10. Indeed, it thinned considerably 20 miles out of Jacksonville. Nick called motel after motel in the Tallahassee area, but everything was booked. So he stretched his search westward and was soon being rejected in Pensacola. Bob called his daughter again and asked her to go online and find some room somewhere along the interstate. Meanwhile, Bruce poked around the crime lab with no luck. Working with a directory, he called several numbers of some officials who appeared to be important, but no one was in. Bob's daughter called with the good news. She had just booked 3 rooms at a small resort near Destin, on the beach. By the time they arrived, they had been in the Tahoe for 11 hours. At the registration desk, Bruce paid for all 3 rooms and was informed that they could stay only 2 nights. They hustled to their rooms and showered. Alone for the first time in what seemed like a week, Bruce went online and began digging for information about Mr. and Mrs. Howard Kerr in the Bay Area. A website listed 4 of them. Nelson was 43, so Bruce guessed that his parents were in their late 60s or early 70s. The first Howard Kerr he called had never heard of Nelson, but the second one knew him well. Nelson's father sounded like a broken man who had just lost his only son and was bewildered by the things he didn't know. Bruce filled in as many gaps as he could without mentioning the possibility of foul play. If that were established, he would call later. After a few minutes, Mr. Kerr went on the speakerphone so Mrs. Kerr could join them. Bruce carefully explained that there were some mysterious elements about the death, and the authorities wanted an autopsy. The parents were not sure they approved, but Bruce said that, as far as he knew, the police could order an autopsy whenever they wanted. Why an autopsy? Why were the police involved? Bruce bobbed and weaved and said that he didn't know all the facts and details, but was trying to gather information. He would know more tomorrow, hopefully, and would update them immediately. Mrs. Kerr broke down, sobbing, and left the conversation. After an excruciating 15 minutes, Bruce managed to end the call with a promise to talk tomorrow. He collected his thoughts, tried to shake off the emotion of talking to grieving parents, put on clean shorts and a t-shirt, and walked to the lobby to join his pals for dinner. 5. Mercer called late that night. The number of fatalities stood at 11, and the news stories looked and sounded awful.
She had not spoken to Larry and was worried about the cottage. Bruce told her they had driven by earlier that morning but had not been able to stop. As far as he could tell, it appeared to be relatively undamaged, though he had seen only the west side. The wind and water came from the ocean. Bruce told her about Nelson, a man she had met only once, but she was shocked nonetheless. He hinted that there were strange circumstances around his death, and the police were investigating. In his opinion, the cleanup would take weeks and months. There was no real rush to reopen the bookstore. The customers were gone. The tourists wouldn't return for a year. He suggested that she wait at least a week before returning to the island. He would check on the cottage as soon as possible and meet with Larry. There was really nothing she could do until electricity was restored. 6. Day 3. The Grand Surf Hotel was on a point at the southern tip of Camino Island, as far away from the destruction as possible. When it opened 30 years earlier, it had been the largest and fanciest hotel on the beach and had become instantly popular with tourists. Locals used it for weddings and parties and fancy dinners. It survived Leo with little damage. Early on the third morning, its lights came on and it was open for business. The owners comped all rooms for rescue workers and utility crews, and the relief teams moved their operations to the hotel parking lot. Crates of food were hauled into the kitchen, and cooks began preparing meals. With dozens of crews working around the clock, electricity spread slowly from the Grand Surf north toward Santa Rosa. A large temporary cell tower was powered up, and some phone service was restored. The first hint of normalcy returned to the devastated island. The Santa Rosa chief of police was a veteran named Carl Logan. He and Hoppy Durden, along with the department's only technician, a part-timer, arrived at Nelson's condo and found it locked. They jammed the patio door, put on rubber gloves and plastic shoe coverings, and entered the kitchen. Hoppy walked Logan through the crime scenario as laid out by that kid who worked at the bookstore and showed him the spatter stains on the wall in the den and the stains on the downstairs vanity. They photographed everything again with better cameras and shot a video. At Logan's suggestion, they withdrew to the patio and decided to call in the state police. There was no word from the crime lab about the autopsy. 7. After a long morning by the pool, Bruce, Bob, and Nick were bored and worried about home. It was impossible to relax with their thoughts occupied by the destruction and chaos on the island. They called friends, grandparents, insurance adjusters, employees. Bruce tried repeatedly to get Hoppy on the phone, but service was not good. They were buoyed by the report that some electricity had been restored. The names of the dead had not been released. At noon, it was announced that the bridge was open to residents, but they were strongly encouraged to stay away for a few more days. The temperature was in the mid-90s, and water was scarce. There was little they could do until the cleanup gained momentum. After lunch, the three packed their small bags, filled the tank with gas, and headed east. Their phones provided comfort, and they talked nonstop. Bruce badgered people at the crime lab but got nothing. Nick searched for motel rooms and found two in Lake City, an hour west of Jacksonville. The traffic grew heavier and slowed their progress considerably. Late in the day, Bruce managed to get Carl Logan on the phone and was relieved to learn that the police were conducting an investigation at some level. Carl said he was waiting on the state boys to send in a team. At least, Hoppy wouldn't be in charge. They ate pizza for dinner at a roadside joint, returned to the crowded interstate, and finally made it to Lake City. By 6 the following morning, day 4, they were on the road in an attempt to beat the traffic. They drove an hour into Jacksonville and parked in the lot beside the state crime lab and waited. At 8:30, they walked into the lobby, and Bruce informed the receptionist that he had an appointment with one Dorothy Grimes, assistant to the field director. He did not, but he had spoken to her on the phone yesterday afternoon and was desperate enough to start lying. Of course, Ms. Grimes was busy at the moment. They took seats in the lobby, found coffee, opened newspapers, and gave every impression that they were there for the duration. An hour passed, and Bruce spoke again to the receptionist. His tone was not quite as friendly. The receptionist said, "Miss Grimes does not have you on her daily calendar." "We spoke yesterday and agreed that I would stop by this morning. Look, this involves the death of a friend who died in the hurricane. His body is somewhere in this building awaiting an autopsy, and I have some valuable information. Can we just treat this as an emergency?"
"I'll see."
"Thank you." Bruce returned to his seat, and she returned to her phone. Half an hour later, a robust woman of about 60 stepped off the elevator and glared at Bruce.
"I'm Dorothy Grimes, assistant to the field director. What's going on here?"
Bruce was immediately in her face with a sappy smile and a limp handshake. "Bruce Cable from Camino Island, we survived the storm, but our friend did not. Can I please have 5 minutes of your time? Call it a humanitarian gesture." She looked him over, then quickly scanned his pals. Shorts, t-shirts, sandals, and sneakers. All three were unshaven, red-eyed, rather unkempt, but the poor guys had just been through a major hurricane.
"Follow me."
Nick and Bob stayed behind as Bruce disappeared into the elevator. Two floors up, he stepped off and followed Dorothy to her office. She closed the door and said,
"You have 5 minutes."
"Thank you. I need to see the field director, Dr. Landrum. It's rather urgent."
"Well, you got to talk to me before you talk to him."
"Okay. My friend Nelson Kerr died in the storm. He has no family here and left my name and number as his contact. His body was brought here for an autopsy. At first, the police thought he had been killed by flying debris. We think otherwise, and I need to know the results of his autopsy. Please, just a few minutes with the boss."
"He can't discuss an autopsy with you, completely against protocol."
"I get that. Nelson's parents are in Fremont near San Jose. They're desperate for information and don't have a clue about what to do next. I'm their contact here. I have to tell them something." She pondered this as she stared at him.
"Are you suggesting foul play or something like that?"
"Yes, but the autopsy should reveal a lot. Please." She took a deep breath, then nodded at a chair.
"Have a seat."
Bruce did as he was told, and she left the office. 15 minutes later, she returned and said,
"Follow me."
Dr. Landrum's office was twice as large and consumed one corner of the floor. He was waiting at the door with a generous smile and a handshake. Undergrad at Florida State, PhD in forensic science from Miami. About 70 and on the fading end of a long career in public service. He waved at chairs and they gathered around his desk. Dorothy remained in the room, now armed with a notepad, like a legal secretary.
"So you wrote out the storm?" Landrum asked pleasantly.
"I did. Not sure how smart it was, and wouldn't recommend it. Do you know the island?"
"Oh, yes. We enjoy the beaches there. It's an easy day trip for us."
"Ever hung out in downtown Santa Rosa?"
"Sure. Some nice restaurants.
And the bookstore?"
"Yeah, several times."
"I own it. I opened Bay Books 23 years ago. You've probably seen me there."
"You don't say. Was it damaged?"
"It took some water, but it's okay. Nelson Kerr was a friend of mine, one of my writers, and I need to tell his parents something. He moved to the island 2 years ago and has no family there."
"I see. The police chief called, and we're sending a crime scene unit to the island today, as soon as we can get across the bridge. I hear it's rather chaotic there. I assume you think it was not an accident?"
"Depends on the autopsy, sir. Has it been performed?"
"It has. It was done yesterday. I'm not allowed to discuss it with you until I meet with our investigators."
"I get that. I'm asking for a favor. A little breach in protocol that no one will ever know about.
You see, Dr. Landrum, I have some information about the crime, if indeed it was a crime, that I cannot share with you until there is a meeting with the investigators. There is a possible witness, a possible suspect, and a possible motive. Landrum looked at Dorothy, who was busy scribbling on her pad. She was of no help.
"Are you sworn to secrecy?"
he asked Bruce. "Whatever you want. I need to tell his family something." Landrum sighed, adjusted his reading glasses, and picked up some papers.
"In layman's terms, the deceased died of multiple blows to the head. 4, to be exact, 2 of which would have been fatal. His cranium was shattered, massive bleeding around the brain. He was struck at the base of his skull with a sharp object that ruptured his spinal cord, and that alone could have been fatal."
Bruce closed his eyes and tried to absorb it. He managed to mumble, "So, he was murdered."
"Sure looks like it, but it's too early to be certain. I suppose it's possible that a man moving around outdoors in a catastrophic hurricane could get hit by debris more than once, but unlikely."
"I agree.
I'm sorry for your loss, Mr. Cable."
"Thank you. And I won't breathe a word of this."
"Please don't. And you say you have additional information."
"I do. A friend of mine and also a friend of Nelson's knows something. We need to chat with your investigator as soon as possible."
"Are you headed back to the island?"
"Yes, but we're in no hurry. My friend is downstairs in the lobby."
"Does he have time to talk?"
"We have plenty of time these days." 8. Things thawed considerably over the next hour as Bruce, Bob, and Nick were escorted to a conference room and served coffee and donuts. As they waited, Bob griped at Bruce for being so gung-ho.
"You could have at least asked me if I wanted to chat with the cops," he growled.
"Oh, you're talking to the cops, Bob. Now knock it off. You're a key witness whether you like it or not." Nick snorted and chimed in.
"You knew the killer and had been sleeping with her for days before the murder. You'll be the first witness called at trial."
"What do you know about trials?"
"Tons. They're in all the crime novels."
"Well, I've sat through one, okay? And I've heard the jury say guilty as charged, so I'm not afraid of the courtroom."
"You did nothing wrong, Bob. Relax," Bruce said. "Don't you want to find the killer?"
"I don't know. Maybe not. If she's a professional, then some very nasty people paid her. Maybe we should leave them alone."
"Not going to happen," Bruce said. "You're in up to your ears."
"Thanks for nothing."
The door eventually opened, and an officer in a suit strutted in. He introduced himself as Captain Butler and passed around business cards, Wesley Butler, Florida State Police. He found the coffee and joined them at the table. Without removing a pen, he asked,
"Now, who's who? Who have we got here?"
"I'm Bruce Cable, friend of Nelson Kerr. Same for Bob Cobb, who's a writer on the island."
"And I'm Nick Sutton, senior at Wake Forest, summer flunky at the bookstore, also a friend of Nelson's."
"Okay. I just saw the autopsy report. Looks like your friend got banged up pretty good. I've talked to the police chief on the island, and he's described the evidence at the crime scene. We'll get there as soon as we can, hopefully in the morning. I understand it's pretty crazy down there."
All three nodded.
"But the crime scene is intact, as far as you know?"
"As far as we know," Bruce said. "There is no one around. In the spirit of full disclosure, the three of us have been in the apartment more than once. Nick here noticed the stains on the wall and in the downstairs bathroom. I walked around upstairs."
"Why?"
"Well, at first we were looking for Nelson's dog. Didn't find him. We were not suspicious until Nick saw the stains. Bob said, then Nick noticed more than one head wound, and we became suspicious." Bruce said, "And just so you'll know, we borrowed his car 2 days ago to return to my home, and we cleaned out his refrigerator and liquor cabinet. Didn't think he would mind."
"A bunch of looters,"
Butler said with a grin.
"Book us. We're guilty. But rules change after a storm when you're worried about survival."
"Okay. You think your prints are in the house?
I'm sure they are. Nick said, we thought about wiping things down, but didn't want to wipe off too much.
Good move. Not sure I've ever investigated a murder in the middle of a hurricane.
It's my first and last, Bruce said. Butler sipped some coffee and said,
now the director says there's more to the story.
It's likely, Bruce said.
Okay. Let's just have a chat without recording anything. We can do that later. I'm fresh on the case and know nothing. Tell me what happened.
Bruce and Nick looked at Bob, who cleared his throat and began.
Well, there was this woman. Said her name was Ingrid.
9. Halfway through Bob's narrative, Butler began taking notes. The story was too rich not to. He never interrupted, but was obviously intrigued by the details. When Bob finished, Butler asked,
and what day did you meet her?
What's today?
Friday, August 9th.
Bruce said, the storm hit late Monday night, August 5th. Bob stared at his phone and said,
I met her a week ago today, Friday the 2nd.
In the bar at the Hilton.
The outdoor bar. There's a big pool scene with a couple of bars.
And you hang out there?
I do indeed. Plenty of action.
Any discernible accent?
Not really. Nothing that I noticed, and being a writer, we usually notice accents.
No accent at all?
No, sir. Flat, middle America. Could have been Kansas or California, not the Bronx or East Texas. Definitely nothing foreign.
How much time did you spend with her?
Too much, I suppose. We met Friday afternoon, had drinks, then retired to my condo. It's a 5-minute walk, and had leftover lobster salad. Went to bed, did our thing, and she slept over. We were having coffee Saturday morning, and that's when Nelson's name came up. She saw one of his books on the shelf and claimed to be a big fan. I had her pegged as a non-reader, or a chick-lit fan at best, and I thought it odd that she would enjoy his books. But I said nothing. The conversation went on, and she said she would like to meet him. She suggested the shack, a dive out by the bridge with really good food.
Been there, too.
So I called Nelson, and we met him there for a late lunch, on Saturday. They hit it off okay, and we had a nice visit. Later that afternoon, she and I hung around the beach, then had dinner again. Back to my place. She wanted to have a go Sunday morning, but I needed a break. She left and said she was going back to the hotel.
Any chance she slept with Nelson?
Oh, sure. Always the chance. Hell, I didn't care. I wasn't thinking about marriage. Tried that twice.
Did you see her Sunday?
Bob sipped coffee, scratched his chin, thought hard for a moment.
Yep. We sat up on the beach near the hotel and enjoyed the sun. That night I had dinner at Bruce's, but didn't take the woman. Nelson was there. Then the hurricane changed its course, and all hell broke loose.
What about a physical description?
5'10", 130, hell of a body. She's about 40 years old, likes string bikinis, and on the beach got more looks than 18-year-olds. Said she lives in the gym and has a black belt. I believe her. Not an ounce of fat anywhere. Brown eyes, long fake blonde hair, no tattoos, scars, birthmarks. And I saw it all.
I don't suppose you took a photo of her. Maybe a selfie?
No, I don't do selfies, and I don't run around snapping photos. Nor did she.
Can you think of a spot where she may have been captured on surveillance?
I thought about that a lot. I'm sure the Hilton has cameras all over the place, including the outdoor bars and pool area. There's probably some footage if it still exists. Right now, the Hilton is a mess. It took at least 8 feet of storm surge, and the ground floor is gutted. The decks, restaurants, patios, terraces were all blown away. Most of its windows are gone. If there were outdoor cameras, they were probably ripped off by the wind. The place is barely standing.
What about the shack?
That's a possibility. I don't know if it survived, but it's on the water, the back bay.
Butler reviewed his notes and sipped coffee. He looked at Bruce, then Bob, and asked,
and you think this gal did a number on Mr. Kerr?
Bob grunted and said,
that's your job, sir.
Bruce nodded at Nick and said, "He has an interesting theory."
"And you're Mr. Sutton?" Butler asked.
"Nick Sutton, rising senior at Wake, summer intern here on the island where I house sit for my grandparents. I hang around the bookstore where Bruce pays me minimum wage to haul stock."
"You're overpaid," Bruce said.
"Anyway, I live in the underbelly because I read 5 or 6 crime novels a week. As an employee, I get a 20% discount, even on paperbacks. At Barnes & Noble, I'd get 40 off. My entire paycheck, meager as it is, goes for my library."
"Okay. And your theory?"
"She's a professional, hired by big money to knock off Nelson because of something he has written or is writing or planning to write. He has a checkered past, to use a badly overworked cliche. She arrived on the island with a pal, probably a man who rented a condo near the scene, and they waited. She knew about Bob and Nelson, easy research. She bumped into Bob, a pushover, and through him met Nelson, her prey. The hurricane presented a unique moment to strike, which she did, and then she and her pal got off the island. Or maybe they're still around, though I doubt it."
"Not bad,"
Butler said with a smile, but it was blatantly obvious he was just humoring the kid. "They can say the darndest things."
"Nice imagination."
"Thanks. I read a lot."
"Any ideas about a murder weapon?"
"Nelson's golf clubs are in the garage. I'd start there."
"Golf clubs?"
"She had to use something from the house. I doubt she showed up with a baseball bat."
"Interesting," Butler said, playing along. "I guess you watch a lot of movies, too."
"Not really. I'm too busy reading." Bruce cleared his throat and said, "Mr. Butler, I have to call Nelson Kerr's parents and tell them something. Should I mention murder?"
"They know he's dead, right?"
"Right. And they know about the autopsy and the involvement by the police."
"I can't tell you what to say. But I would tell them that he died from blunt force trauma to the head. Looks suspicious, and the state police have opened an investigation."
"Okay. And how do they get the body to California? I've never dealt with this before."
"Most folks haven't. Hire a local funeral home. They do it all the time."
10. Butler walked them out of the building and to the parking lot, where he lit a cigarette and seemed in no hurry. As they said goodbye and shook hands, Bruce remembered something. Nelson had just finished his latest novel, or at least an early draft. "I was about to read it. The book is not under contract, so no one in New York has seen it. I'm almost certain that it's still in his computer, and that file is pretty valuable to his estate." Butler nodded confidently.
"We'll secure it."
Driving away, Nick said, "I don't trust him. He's cocky, smug, and not very bright. He and Hoppy will make quite a team."
"He didn't care for your postulating, did he?"
Bob said with a laugh. "No, he thinks I'm a nut. You see his type all the time, at least in good crime novels. These guys who've been around think they can look at a crime scene and name the killer. It's called tunnel vision. They embrace their own theory, then march off in the wrong direction. They ignore facts to the contrary and embrace anything that supports their ideas. Happens all the time, especially in real-life wrongful conviction cases where they nail some poor dude while the real killer keeps on killing."
Bruce said, "I didn't think he was that bad."
"He's not too bright, Bruce," Bob said. "Nick's right for a change." "It's almost noon," Nick said. "Is anybody else hungry around here?"
"Always," Bruce said, "and thirsty.
How many cold beers are left?"
"Plenty," Nick said from the back. "Where are we going?"
"I'm tired of driving and tired of both of you," Bruce said. "I say we go home and end this little road trip."
"Amen,"
Bob said. Nick opened one of the coolers, passed out sandwiches and beers, and they enjoyed lunch as they sped around the Jacksonville bypass. Half an hour later, they exited Interstate 95 under the 4-lane that ran 20 miles to the bridge and the island. They immediately noticed a caravan of dump trucks loaded with debris headed farther west to the county landfill. They passed a field where hundreds of FEMA trailers were parked.
Eastbound traffic was heavy, but moving well at first. But after 5 miles, it slowed, then practically stopped. Most were cars, but there were dozens of trailers with backhoes, bulldozers, and loaders headed for the cleanup. They inched along sipping beer, listening to 1980s golden hits because they could agree on nothing else. Nick said, "Okay, you want my latest theory?" Bruce slowly reached over and turned down the volume. He was intrigued by the deft workings of Nick's criminal mind. Bob nodded and asked, "Are you going to tell us regardless of whether we want to hear it?" "Yes. The real killer is the guy with the cash. Nelson published 3 novels about arms dealers, drug dealers, money launderers, gun runners, corporate crooks, shady defense contractors, and so on. Right, Bruce?" "For the most part." "He seemed to really know his subject matter. Let's assume he pissed off some folks along the way. If so, why would they rub him out now? The books have been published. Most have sold well. It's all fiction, all make-believe anyway, so why get upset?" "Your point?" Bob asked. "My point is that what's been said has been said, and Nelson is certainly not the first novelist to write about arms dealers. My point is that the next book, the unfinished novel, is what got him killed. Somebody out there didn't want it published." Bruce and Bob nodded along. Nick went on. "Maybe they knew his subject matter. It wouldn't be that hard to figure out, since he always did quite a bit of research. Word got out that Nelson Kerr was writing about their business or their crimes. Or maybe they hacked him, read it, and felt threatened." Bruce said, "Nelson was afraid of getting hacked and worked offline. His desktop was secure. Other writers have had their stuff stolen. He was a fanatic about keeping his material protected." Bob asked, "How did he back up his work? The cloud?" "Don't know, but I doubt if he used the cloud." "How did he communicate?" Nick asked. "He used a laptop for emails, but even then he never said much. He was almost paranoid. No social media at all. He changed his phone number every few months." "So he was still an amateur and he could get hacked. There's always somebody smarter. If the Russians and Chinese can hack the CIA, then our late buddy Nelson could be hacked. Wouldn't he have sent his manuscript to his agent, maybe his editor?" "His agent died last year, and he was in the process of finding a new one. He and I talked about it at length. A month ago, he told me the book was almost finished and no one had read it. He wanted me to have a look and make notes. I'll bet the manuscript is still in his computer. Where else would it be?" Bob said, "So after she killed him, she took his hard drive." "Don't know yet," Nick said. "But if his hard drive is missing, then one part of the mystery is solved." "Why didn't you think of this sooner?" Bruce asked. "We could have checked his computer." "We weren't touching anything," Nick said. "I got the impression that Butler back there sort of suspects us of something anyway." "I'm glad you said that," Bob replied. "I had the same impression. What will he do when they find our fingerprints?" "We have solid alibis," Bruce said. They inched along in silence, at times approaching 10 miles per hour, at times sitting still. Bruce's phone buzzed and he answered it. He listened, mumbled something about dog searching, and shook his head in disbelief. He ended the call and said, "You're not going to believe this. The cops have the road blocked this side of the bridge, and they're searching each car with dogs. Can you please tell me why?" Bob, the ex-felon, had little use for the police. He shook his head and said, "Because they can." Bruce was exasperated. "I mean, these people just had their homes and businesses blown away, so why would they want to sneak explosives onto the island? These cops are out of control." Bob said, "For the same reason they sent SWAT teams to arrest people for bad checks. Because they can, and it's far more dramatic. These guys think they're as tough as Navy SEALs, and they have to prove it. Look at all that military garb they wear. Why does every podunk police department have a tank these days? Because the Pentagon has too much of the stuff and sells it cheap. Why do they send canine units to sniff around the county fair?
because they have the damn dogs and need to use them. Don't get me started.
I think you've already started, Nick observed from the back seat.
Why does every fender bender need 3 cop cars and 4 fire trucks? Because these guys are bored sitting around the station, and they get their jollies racing up and down the streets with sirens screaming. Tough boys in action. They like to block traffic in all directions, makes them feel powerful. They control the situation. Sniffing dogs? Unbelievable. It'll be midnight before we get there.
Bruce paused a few seconds and asked, Do you feel better now?
Not really. I got chewed up by the cops, okay? So I carry a grudge. I'd feel better if this traffic was moving. Whose idea was this road trip after all?
Nick's.
Blame me for everything, Nick said. I'm just the intern.
Bruce picked up his phone and said, Look, I've been putting this off, but I need to call Nelson's father and tell him that his son is not only dead, but was probably murdered. You guys want to help?
Sorry, Nick said. He named you as his contact, Bob said. It's all yours.
The Tahoe stopped in a long curve. For miles ahead, nothing was moving. Bruce found the number and punched redial. 11. Mr. Kerr could barely talk and handed the phone to his daughter, Polly. She introduced herself with,
I'm Nelson's sister, his only sibling. Thank you for what you're doing.
She sounded calm, in control. Bruce said, I really haven't done anything. I'm very sorry for your loss. Nelson was a friend.
Where is he now?
As far as I know, he's in the morgue at the state crime lab. We just left there and are trying to get back onto the island. Things are a mess.
What happened? What can you tell me?
Bruce hesitated and did not want to talk about the cause of death. We met with an investigator for the state police. They have opened a case file and will send a team of technicians to Nelson's condo tomorrow.
For what purpose?
To gather evidence to determine if a crime was committed.
Was my brother murdered?
No one knows the answer to that. She paused, and Bruce could almost see her gritting her teeth and trying to maintain composure. He tried to imagine their nightmare, stumbling through the dark 2,000 miles away and watching the chaos on television. She said,
Okay, I'm leaving in an hour, and I'll land in Jacksonville at 8 in the morning. That's the plan, though the airline said there could be delays because of everything. I think I have a rental car. Will it be possible for me to get on the island?
Probably. The bridge is open, and we're trying to get there now.
I assume there are no hotel rooms?
Correct. It appears as if most of the hotels are damaged. I have a big house with plenty of room. A couple of friends are staying over, and we're sort of camping out. No electricity now, but we might get hooked up tomorrow. We have food and water, and we're getting by. You're welcome to join us.
That's awfully generous, Mr. Cable.
It's Bruce, and I'm not being generous. It's called survival.
Thank you. This is very hard.
Her voice cracked slightly. I cannot imagine. I'm sorry.
Is there something we should be doing?
Have you talked to a funeral home?
No, not yet.
Okay, we have. Text me your cell number, and I'll text you the number of a reputable funeral home in Jacksonville. I chatted with the director an hour ago. Once he is hired, they will transfer the body to the funeral home and prepare it for shipment. He realized he sounded like they were discussing a FedEx package.
She said, Thank you. I'll do that right now. Will you be around in the morning?
Oh, yes. Waiting for you. We'll go to Nelson's condo and have a look.